This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. What happens once the sun goes down raises a lot of seemingly simple questions. Is dark, for example, just the absence of light, or is it the natural state of things? Are human beings diurnal animals, or after 9 months in our mother's wombs, are we children of the night? And are fire lamps and electric lights tools against the darkness or against time? For many of us, night is a lonely companion, filled with introspection and populated by monsters that lurk under our beds. But others celebrate sundown as liberation from the workaday and as the dawn of a sky full of wonders. For much of this program, we'll explore the animals, the revels, the nature, and the phenomena of the night. Later in the program, the ABCs of American intelligence agencies. But first, the worlds of darkness. What do you find particularly scary or alluring about the night? Call and tell us your most memorable night story, or call and ask about what you find most intriguing or puzzling about the night. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Christopher Dewdney. He's the author of the new book, Acquainted with the Night, Excursions Through the World After Dark. He's with us from the studios of the CBC in Toronto, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
You begin your book with an apparently naive question that turns out to have some pretty interesting answers. Why is it dark at night?
Well, at first, it seemed obvious, as Shakespeare said, an obvious reason for darkness at night is the lack of the sun. But by the early 1800s, well, 1830s, sorry, scientists knew enough about the universe and about physics and about light to realize that everywhere you look at night, there is a star at the end of that point of vision. So they realized that by 1826, they realized that the night sky really should theoretically be as bright as the day. There was no reason why all the accumulated starlight wouldn't build up and make a very bright night sky. So this became an enigma. It's called Olber's enigma, and it wasn't solved until 1926, when the American astronomer Edwin Hubble discovered that the universe was expanding, and that was where all the light was going.
His answer, though, was intuited, I guess, by a poet. That must have broken your heart as a poet yourself.
Yes, that's true. It was Edgar Allan Poe, oddly enough, wrote a poem where he, a speculative poem where he was speculating that perhaps the universe had had a beginning, and that was where all the light was going. And surprisingly enough, he turned out to be right.
Well, he turned out to be right about a couple of other things, some more metaphorically than specifically. Anyway.
Yes.
One of the curiosities that amongst the many that I found in your book is that you list the U.S. Naval Observatory's three stages of twilight, of which I was unaware.
Yes. In fact, before I started researching the book, I was unaware of these stages myself, and they turned out to be a wonderful structure, particularly for the beginning of the book, because they're very precise. The Naval Observatory recognizes three stages. First of all, civil twilight, which is when car headlights are legally supposed to be turned on just after sundown. Then about half an hour later, they have a phase called nautical twilight, which is when ships at sea can see enough stars that they can navigate by. And then the final phase is celestial twilight, or
astronomical.
When you can see the faintest stars.
Astronomical twilight, I think.
Astronomical twilight, yes.
Yeah. And that's when even the faintest stars that are visible become visible. Of course, we see fewer and fewer of those every day, at least those of us who live in cities.
That's right. Well, light pollution is becoming, and it's something that I talk about in the book, because as it turns out, light pollution has some, researchers have discovered it has some fairly negative effects. In fact, it can cause certain illnesses and even diseases. And in the cities, of course, we are robbed of the natural spectacle of a starry night sky. All cities except, of course, for Tucson, Arizona, which has very stringent light pollution bylaws. And the citizens of that city can, it's about 800,000, I think, when they're downtown, they can look up and see the entire Milky Way just with a few light covers.
That technology, why isn't it spreading, do you think?
I don't think it's a popular, I mean, it's an add-on. Municipalities are not very much aware of it. There is, however, an international organization called the International Dark Sky, organization who are sort of the Greenpeace of the night sky. And they are lobbying intensively around the world to try and curtail light pollution as much as possible.
One of the things, again, I did not realize until I read your book, I hadn't thought about it really, there's a size to the night.
Yes, that's right. I think it's about 93 million square miles, about the size of the Pacific Ocean. I derived that site using mathematics and using the Naval Observatory's definition of night. And I realized that, of course, half the planet, it being a sphere, is dark and the other half is light. But because of the atmosphere, a little bit of light diffuses. So I decided that the real night starts when the faintest stars are available, which, of course, is nautical twilight by the U.S. Naval Observatory's definition. And then I calculated the square area of night from that. So it's about the size of the Pacific Ocean.
And whirls around the globe how fast?
Well, it depends on your latitude. At the equator, you know, because as you move further north, the Earth is spinning less quickly relative to the sunset. So at the equator, the sunset arrives at about 1,000 miles an hour. Los Angeles receives sunset at about 750 miles an hour, just around the speed of sound. And at the North Pole, of course, it's zero, which is why, and here's another weird thing I discovered, is that the North Pole and the South Pole each experience only one day and one night a year, and each of them 175 days long.
But that fabulous speed at the equator, that's why the sunset seems to be so quick at the equator, right?
Well, as the British were fond of intoning, the tropical night falls like a curtain, and actually they were quite right. It does actually happen faster there.
And there is a phenomenon you write about at some length, most visible over water and most visible as you get towards the equator, the famous green blink.
Yes, the green flash. As they call it. Now, that's a very interesting phenomenon. It's very difficult to see. You really have to have a very clear, fairly calm day with a high pressure area and few clouds and a horizon that's very stable, not too windy or wavy. And as the sun goes down, I mean, you notice this effect. Most people notice the sun turns red as it lowers. But as the atmosphere begins to diffract it, as the sun gets even lower, it deflects into whole wavelengths. It goes from red to yellow. And then I don't know if you've noticed that this or some of our listeners have noticed this, but sometimes the sun actually divides into little horizontal bands. And these bands go through the spectrum. And if you're lucky enough, on a very clear day over the ocean, you can see a little green band just for a moment after the sun has set. It's called the green flash. It's a beautiful color.
I've had the good fortune to see it from a ship in the North Pacific, but you write about something that's even rarer than seeing the green flash.
That's right, the blue flash. And this has been seen only by very few observers. And the person who saw it that I read, the article that I read by them, I haven't seen it myself, saw it in the Alps, apparently on a very clear day over the ocean or some kind of flat, it must have had a flat horizon. Mm-hmm. So they were quite high in relative to the horizon. But it can be seen apparently on the ocean.
We're talking about the night, and we've barely even started. We're still talking about sundown with Christopher Dewdney. He's the author of a new book, Acquainted with the Night. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And let's talk with Brad, who's with us from Denver, Colorado.
How are you gentlemen doing today?
Very well, thanks.
Very good. I'm a photographer and planned on being a professional photographer and studied in college and did a lot of nighttime photography and there's a lot of frustration with the absence of light, of course, because the film is sensitive to light and with my long shutter speeds and I just wanted to comment on that and although I did enjoy the quietness and the peacefulness of doing nighttime photography, it was frustrating sometimes in my results. So, just a comment, really.
Well, I guess you're talking about the difficulty of gathering light in the dark.
Yeah, gathering light in the dark. There's always light there, no matter. Well. I guess there's not always light there, but in my experience, photographing, you just have to leave your shutter open, and you'll find something, you know.
Yeah, so there's always stray photons wandering around. You know, what you're experiencing is the same kind of experience that I have a chapter in a book about deep sea fish as inhabitants of the sort of an infinite, eternal darkness, and they have very, very, very low light levels, even lower than we could possibly experience at night here in the atmosphere, and they have very sensitive eyes that can pull in even a measurable amount of 10 or 15 photons and use that to guide their swimming.
Thanks very much, Brad. And you also write at some length about the different ways that animals, not just the deep sea creatures, but those that inhabit the night, the nocturnal animals, those that inhabit the night, gather what light there is available.
Yes, they have a really sophisticated light-gathering eyes. The big cats and all those animals that you see if you're driving at night and you see a little, when you see their eyes and their eyes reflect back, and cats' eyes are famous for that, and as are most nocturnal mammals at any rate, and some birds too, because they have a layer behind their retina called the tapis lucidum that actually re-reflects light back to their retina so that they, it's sort of like a mirror behind your retina, so that the light is doubled. They efficiently double any light that falls on their retina and amplifies it at night.
And there's another phenomenon that I wanted to talk about called bioluminescence that you write about. It's an extraordinary phenomenon. We mostly associate it with fireflies, of course.
Yes, fireflies are definitely bioluminescent organisms, and they're something that really are extraordinary. There's two experiences. Well, one experience I haven't had and one experience I did have. The first one was with the one that I haven't had is accounts of biologists of fireflies in the tropics. And apparently these are not rare, who all the fireflies alight in one tree. They evenly distribute themselves around the branches and the trunk, and then they synchronize their flashes so that the tree sort of flashes on and off like a neon sign. Scientists, in the deep jungle, coming upon a tree like this, are stunned. They say it's an amazing experience because the first thing that your mind and eye thinks is that is a neon sign. That's an amazing thing that I would love to see. But what I have experienced is bioluminescence in the Caribbean one time when I was swimming with my daughter. We'd flown from from the winter here, and I was trying to escape the winter, and I was insisting that we swim, shovel snow in the morning, and then swim in the Caribbean in the afternoon. But, of course, the flight delays. By the time we got there, it was after sundown. But I said, we have to go swimming, so we went in anyway. It's not really visible after dark, but... And the water was filled with sparks. Every time I splashed, I'd see what looked to be little green sparks. And at first, I didn't know what was going on. But then I realized, oh, this is bioluminescence. That's right. And we were just, it was just wonderful because you could stroke the water with your hands and leave these emerald trails of sparks. It was magical.
There's a fabulous description. The book is worth it just for this rediscovery of this passage from My Family and Other Animals, a description of what happened off the coast of Corfu in Greece. With the fireflies above and the illuminated porpoises below, he's talking about in bioluminescent water, it was a fantastic sight. We could even see the luminous trails beneath the surfaces where the porpoises swam in fiery patterns across the sandy bottom. And when they leapt high into the air, drops of emerald glowing water flicked from them, and you could not tell if it was phosphorescence or fireflies you were looking at. For an hour or so, we watched this pageant, and then slowly the fireflies drifted back inland and further down the coast. Then the porpoises lined up and sped out to sea, leaving a flaming path behind them that flickered and glowed and then died slowly like a glowing branch laid across the bay. Boy, that's good stuff.
Isn't that amazing? I had to put that whole passage in because I just loved it so much.
We're speaking with Christopher Dewdney. He's the author of a new book, Acquainted with the Night, Excursions Through the World After Dark. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. When we come back, we're going to be talking about some of the mysteries of sleep. You can also email us, of course, whether you're awake or asleep, TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the mystery and magic of night, and joining us is Christopher Dewdney, the author of Acquainted with the Night, Excursions Through the World After Dark. The title of the book comes from the Robert Frost poem, Acquainted with the Night. We played a little bit of it at the top of the program. It was published in 1928. Let's listen to the reading of the poem by Robert Frost himself.
I have been one acquainted with the night. I have walked out in rain and back in rain. I have outwalked the furthest city light. I have looked down the saddest city lane. I have passed by the watchman on his beat and dropped my eyes, unwilling to explain. I have stood still and stopped the sound of feet when far away an interrupted cry came over houses from another street, but not to call me back or say goodbye. And further still, at an unearthly height, one luminary clock against the sky proclaimed the time was neither wrong nor right. I have been one acquainted with the night.
Robert Frost. If you have favorite stories, poems, pieces of music, or works of art about the night, give us a phone call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, totn@npr.org. Let's get another listener on the line, and this is Morgan, who's with us from Tempe, Arizona.
Hello.
Hello.
Just before the break, your guest had mentioned about animals reflecting light during the night with their eyes, you know, sort of the mirror effect. And my question was, during the day, if that still occurs, how does that keep from hurting the animal's eyes? As I know, sitting here in my car during the middle of the day in bright, sunny Tempe, that I have to wear sunglasses to keep from being blinded constantly.
Well, that's a really good question, and that's the reason why most nocturnal animals have vertical or slit pupils. You'll notice with cats and with lizards, nocturnal lizards, that their pupils are able to narrow even more narrow than the smallest little pupil size. The only exception to that rule, of course, is owls, but even they have slightly elliptical pupils.
So that protects them during the day?
That protects them. They can narrow those right down to just a sliver, so you can barely see any black at all.
Hmm. Thanks.
Go ahead. If you look at a house cat, you'll see that during the day in a bright light.
Yeah, you see a lot more mysteries in their eyes than that. Morgan, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Let's call now with Chris, and Chris is on the line from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, how you doing?
All right.
Hi.
Oh, great show. I just had a question about night vision technology. I don't know if you go into it with your book. Just as far as how the invisible light rays of the spectrum are made visible for people to see with this technology, and why it's always there as opposed to visible light. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks Chris.
That's a good question. Now, of course, there are two types of night vision. There's active night vision, where a infrared light is shone, which is invisible to most, even actually animals and people, is shone on the and used like a searchlight, and then the receptors pick that up. But there's passive night vision, which is mostly what's used by the U.S. military, which is entirely different. That's a complete light amplification system. And the reason it's green is because green is the easiest color for us to make out detail in and depth, curiously enough. So it could have been any color. It could have been red or orange or blue even, but green is the best color to see in. So that's why they're always that eerie green color. But those passive light systems are purely amplification systems.
One of the things you also go into at some great length is sleep, which is something that the body, the chemistry of sleep was fascinating to me.
Well, it was surprising to me too. I had no idea that there was so much activity going on in our bodies that melatonin starts to be, in the average circadian rhythm, and most of us, even people who work at night, have the same rhythm, starts melatonin, which is a kind of a hormone that makes us sort of soporific, starts to be secreted by the body about 8 p.m. About between 10 and 11 p.m., the body starts to shut down your digestive process, as well as another hormone is secreted, which stops the urinary tract from producing, for the kidneys from stopping to function, or at least slowing down. So we really sort of become hormonally changed. And it does actually changes their psychology somewhat, too. So on your way to the dreamland, you've actually started, in a sense, a preparatory process. I discovered also that another hormone called cortisol is secreted starts to be secreted around maybe 5 a.m., 4 to 5 a.m., and it's sort of like an onboard caffeine that begins to prepare us to wake up. So there's a whole series of hormones that activate various processes all night long.
Let's talk with Lynn, who joins us on the line from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Lynn,
gentlemen.
Hi, Lynn.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question really is kind of like the hardwiring between people who are more left brain to right brain. My family's kind of divided down the middle. And those of us that are more right brain and creative, we have a tendency to be night owls and we stay up all night. I'm a metalsmith, and when I was in college, I would pull all-nighters. And I thought I'd grow out of it, but I'm almost reaching 40, and I still do that.
So you really tend to be up more at night?
Mm-hmm. It's like I actually start to come awake and come alive about 10 o'clock in the evening, and I can stay up till like 5 in the morning doing my work, go to bed, and get up at about 9 in the morning, and I'm fine.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people.
My mother is in her 70s, and she still does the same thing as well, whereas my father, who was very left brain, very analytical, would go to bed at 10 at night, and I have a sister and brother do the same thing. They're into bed early, they get up early, and they need more sleep, and they're not night people.
Hmm.
Well, that's true of a lot of writers and artists, too. When you brought up a very good point, many literary luminaries, Charlotte Bronte, Charles Dickens, even politicians like Margaret Thatcher were night people. And there is a period of lucidity. If you fight the resisting impulse to go to sleep, you know, at 11, say, then there is an actual period of lucidity that lasts from about 11 to 1 or 2 a.m.,
mm-hmm.
where the mind is actually sharper.
Mm-hmm.
That's when a lot of literary people seem to do their best work.
Right. Yeah, and
certainly
that's
true.
My experience. So there is something to say about right brain versus left brain.
Well, yes, I'm not sure how that fits in, the right and left brain. It's an interesting
idea.
And
if it's true, I'm not sure how Margaret Thatcher fits in. Lynn, you say you work in metal, so you're welding and hammering at night?
Yeah, actually, I'm a fine arts a metalsmith.
I have
my own studio, so I stay up late at night.
And very tolerant neighbors, I take it.
I have a tendency to try to be quiet and polite.
Good luck with it, Lynn.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye, gentlemen. Bye-bye.
Let's now talk with Michael, and Michael's with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Yes, hi there.
Hi.
I'm a deep space artist, and I've come out to Arizona to work, and I find that nighttime is the only time I can really, really go nuts with my art. I've tried during the day, but maybe it's the subject, I don't know, but that's where I have my energy. I've just kind of fallen up with her call. I work with a blowtorch, and I work with wax, and I use Hubble telescope images to as inspiration, but I don't know why.
What better time to work than at night on a night subject, though? You could just step out the door and get your inspiration.
But it must be a little intimidating to be, the great work of the night sky, and then your humble efforts inside.
Absolutely. And one other point I wanted to make is to follow up on the cities that are actually making having ordinances to protect the night sky outside of Scottsdale, a little town called Fountain Hills. And it's just a beautiful place to be because you can't see the deep night sky so close to Phoenix, just on the other side of the mountain. So it does work, I guess.
Okay. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's get another caller in, and we'll go with Anne, who's with us from Cadillac, Michigan.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to share my most memorable experience, nighttime experience. There have been a lot of them, but the very first time that I went night skiing was under a bright, bright full moon. And I went with a few friends, and as we went along, we were on trails that went out of the woods and into the woods, and as we went along, our eyes adjusted more and more and more, and after a while, it became as if we were gliding through a black and white movie, except that it was actually more like a deep blue. Everything had a sort of a blueness to it, and you could see all the detail you needed to see in terms of where you were going and all. It was physically a very sensory experience too, because since you couldn't see the tracks that you were going in, you really had to feel where you were going with your feet and your knees and everything. And it was such a different way of perceiving the night, the world.
Sounds exhilarating.
What a wonderful experience.
It was so incredible.
That's a classic.
Kristen.
And if I could, I just wanted to share a two-line poem that was set to music. It's called Epitaph.
Go ahead.
Though my soul may set in darkness, it will rise in perfect light. I have loved the stars too fondly to be fearful of the night.
That's lovely.
That's nice, Anne. Thank you. Who wrote
Thank
that?
Thank you. You know, I'm sorry, I don't know who wrote it. I just know that it's called Epitaph.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go now with Zach. Zach joins us from St. Charles, Illinois.
Hi, great show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Basically, what this topic got me thinking about was, as a kid, how the whole nightlight thing, and as you grow older, it kind of becomes less of wanting light when you go to sleep and more of complete darkness. Now, that's a college kid's perspective, so.
It's interesting. We got an email on that subject from Lori Gray in St. Paul, Minnesota. I was afraid of the dark even as a teenager. I used to sleep with my light on every night. That is until my mother pointed out to me that with my light on, I was much more visible to anyone or anything that might be outside the window. I've slept with the light off ever since.
Her mother did her a favor, too, because apparently even small amounts of light at night are deleterious to your health, as it turns out.
That's interesting.
So do you sleep with the light on now, Zach?
No. Complete darkness. Any light will ruin sleep.
Okay. That's good.
Thanks very much.
Quick question.
Go ahead.
Have you found anything like animals as you get into like primates as opposed to any kind of other animals where light is sometimes a comfort at all?
Some civilized, relatively civilized chimpanzees who have been in zoos or who've lived with people get the same difficulties and can be trained to have the same phobias about darkness as humans, but not naturally occurring.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Zach.
Bye.
Thanks.
It was interesting thinking back to the experience of the woman skiing down down a moonlit slope, the sense of the feel of it. You write about the I guess it may be a fad, who knows, restaurants that are serving food in complete darkness.
Yes, there's one, I think it's called Das New Cow or something like that in Austria right now, where the patrons are served, and this must be a passing fad, I'm sure, although they're thinking of licensing one in New York City, where the patrons are served in complete darkness. They have to eat, I don't know how you do this, frankly, but this does exist. And the staff, all the people who serve them, are legally blind, so that they can negotiate the darkness and are quite used to it, of course. And the patrons eat very apparently Epicurean fare, very good food, without any light whatsoever. And this is supposed to enhance the flavor and taste of what is already fairly good food.
Go figure. We're talking with Christopher Dewdney. His new book is Acquainted with the Night: Excursions Through the World After Dark. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is David, who's with us from Durham, North Carolina.
Hi. I'm very fascinated by this show. I wanted to recommend a poem. I'm pretty sure Christopher Dewdney knows it. It's a longish poem called Nightwalker by the Irish poet Thomas Kinsley.
Oh, yes.
Which is basically a brooding walk in the middle of the night through Dublin. And it doesn't work well in quotation, but all sorts of things pass through his mind and various constellations and the moon and so forth are used as occasions for reflection on Irish history and politics and so forth.
Go ahead, Christopher.
Yes, no, that's an essential. That was part of my research. Of course, I had to read through that to. But as you say, it's very contextual, and
yeah.
It's really a long piece. But that's an important.
Well, it generally
piece.
Doesn't quote well, but it's an amazing piece.
I think you're right.
You do for this book an astonishing number of quotations from poets, Thomas More, for example, and the best of all ways to lengthen our days is to steal a few hours from the night, my dear.
Yes,
I was particularly fond of that one, The Dark Frontier.
Yes, I love that one too.
Have you written a poem about the night?
I've written a fair amount about the night. It's been for me one of my. I mean, I'm a lover of the night, of the darkness, particularly summer nights, which we're experiencing excellent ones right now in North America. I've written a fair number of poetry about a fair number of poems that include night topics. And although I didn't bring them here to the studio, I should have been a little better prepared, perhaps. But there are some sequences, I think, in this book which are as poetic as anything I've written in terms of poetry.
Let's get another caller on the line. Is there something that you wanted to read?
Well, there is just at the very beginning a little piece that explains night. It might be good.
And I hope it's about a minute long.
Yes.
Good.
it'll just take me a little bit here to find it. I haven't got the actual page.
While you're looking it up, let me tell our listeners that tomorrow is the 35th anniversary of the moon landing, speaking of night. We'd like to hear your stories tomorrow about space. If you have any special stories or ideas about the event, where you were, what you were doing, what it meant to you, drop us a short email. Please include your phone number so we can call you back and you can share your thoughts with us on the air. Again, tomorrow is the 35th anniversary of the moon landing. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Now, have you managed to locate the passage?
Yes, I have a section here, which is somewhat lyrical. Deeply, intimately, we are shaped by night. It is part of us. The rhythms of our bodies, the ebb and flow of our moods, the very pulse of our minds are vitally linked to the daily cycle of light and dark. For some, night may be a time of anxiety, of loneliness, and apprehension. For others, it is a celebratory time of freedom from work, of sensual pleasures and entertainments. Night is when we can put the worries of the day behind, yet it is also a frontier in which we are blind, where unseen dangers lurk. We are creatures of the day, and night has historically been our adversary, an exception to the rule of light. But in the larger universe, the reverse is true. Night is the rule, and light is the exception. Daylight is bracketed by darkness, and our sun floats within the immensity of an endless cosmic night. But this universal night is not barren. It is the fertile void from which all things, even light itself, are born.
An excerpt from Acquainted with the Night by Christopher Dewdney. We'll have more with him after the break, plus the ABCs of American intelligence. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Our guest is Christopher Dewdney. He's the author of the book Acquainted with the Night, Excursions Through the World After Dark, and I guess we should begin. We've located the poem a listener called in with a couple of lines called Epitaph. She called Epitaph. It turns out they're the last two lines of a poem called The Old Astronomer to His Pupil by Sarah Williams, and were used as an epitaph for an astronomer couple that was buried at the Allegheny Observatory. So The Old Astronomer to His Pupil, though my soul may set in darkness, it will rise in perfect light. I have loved the stars too fondly to be fearful of the night. So Christopher Dewdney and the rest of us can find that by going on about that. Anyway, let's get another caller on the line, and Dave joins us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to relay a story quickly. I was a student at the Naval Nuclear Power School when it was in Orlando. One of the physics teachers there made a comment because, you know, being involved in nuclear power, you sort of develop an odd sense of humor. But he made it a point of saying that light bulbs do not, in fact, emit light. And fluorescent lights do not emit light. What they do is they suck up darkness. And the reason that they stop working is they're full.
That's a great idea. Well, only a physicist could say something as perverse as that.
Well, I just thought that would be an interesting story to relay.
Appreciate
that idea.
Appreciate the phone call, Dave.
I do.
You raise the interesting point in your book that, in a way, that the invention of everything from fire to torches to lamps to the electric light, the fluorescent lights that our caller was just mentioning, aren't so much tools against the darkness as now they're being used against time itself.
That's right, because as we progressively gotten more and more adept at lighting the night, it is pushing back a frontier of time, which was normally closed to us. So, I mean, we have the frontier of space, we have the frontier of the water, the frontier of air, all of which we've conquered. Now we're actually conquering the frontier of time by pushing back. In fact, you could say perhaps that we've already pushed that time frontier back now to 24 hours a day, because in the perpetually lit world of the city, it seems that that night has been banished, and so that we have conquered that time, that last frontier of time.
Yep, not our body chemistry, though, that tells us what time it is to go to sleep. Yeah. Let's get one more caller in, and this is Jada, who joins us from Hawaii.
Hi.
Hi.
I've got two questions, actually. The first one is about moonbows, I guess they're called, which are rainbows cast by the moon. Not the rainbows around the moon, but when you actually see a rainbow out that's being cast by moonlight. And I saw it once on a boat on a full moon night off the coast of Maui, and it was absolutely beautiful. You could see the whole spectrum of the rainbow, but very, very faintly. And then underneath, it was raining out to sea, but clear where we were in the boat. And the moon was kind of behind us, casting towards the sea, I guess. And underneath the bow was like a shimmering curtain of silver where the rain was falling and catching the moonlight underneath this moon bow. And I asked the captain of the boat, and he said in 40 years he'd never seen that, but he'd heard of them, and that they were even rarer than the green flash. And I was wondering, why are they so rare?
The conditions for something like that, as the captain related to you, are very, very unusual and come very rarely, because the moon has to be, you know, in the right position behind you for that to occur. Mm-hmm. There is one place in the world where there are moon bows. Are much more regular, which is Victoria Falls, on the edge of Zimbabwe in South Africa. And at night, when the moon is full there, you can see fairly regularly a moon bow, which apparently is one of the most beautiful sights, because it's eerie. The colors are so subtle, like violets and greens, but apparently it's an amazing sight. So what you've seen is something you've been vouchsafed an extraordinary night vision.
Yeah, I realized it at the time. It was wonderful.
Yeah, that's really something. You're lucky.
Yeah, and my other question is, I'm an anthropologist, and I've lived in a lot of countries in Asia. And one of the things that was most shocking to me was that people didn't sleep in the dark and didn't expect that it needed to be dark to sleep well. And especially in Indonesia, where I've lived the most, and my husband's Indonesian, everybody sleeps with light on. And he had to learn to sleep in the dark with me, because I couldn't tolerate sleeping with any light on in the room. And I wondered if you've sort of looked at relationships to nighttime and sleeping cross-culturally, and or if you know of any that have...
I didn't look at that specifically, because that was sort of a topic unto itself, the various cultural ways of mediating darkness and the various practices when it comes to electric lighting, or perhaps even before electric lighting. What I did find interesting, though, about the Philippine and the Vietnamese was this sudden unexplained nightmare death syndrome. It's called SUNDS. I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but there's a sort of a little bit of a dark note, I suppose, but there were these, they seem to be suffering, men, and was a genetic, some sort of genetic disposition, to have fatal nightmares where they're literally scared to death, a very strange thing. It's still going on, particularly among the Hmong, H-M-O-N-G tribe, of which were Vietnamese.
On the Laotian border, yeah.
Yes, that's right. And they were particularly susceptible to it, but also in the Philippines as well. And simply males, and always genetically linked, it seems. But these people would actually have nightmares so severe that they were fatal. And otherwise healthy people. A very curious syndrome.
Chadda, thanks.
One of the things I discovered.
Thanks very much for the call. And
I'll
look for moonbows from now on.
Yes.
And Christopher Dewdney, we thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Christopher Dewdney is the author of the new book, Acquainted with the Night, Excursions Through the World After Dark. He joined us from the studios of the CBC in Toronto.